Welcome to another Leon Chani Report, and we have a very important report tonight. We have the Consul General of Israel with us from New York, and usually used to be with Puerto Rico, too. I don't know if they still go down there. I know Savir, used to have Puerto Rico in the tropics, but now is not the time for vacation. Paul Maidman, who's been now appointed editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine, and Lane Green with The Economist. So we're going to cover Gaza and the Middle East, unless you have something else to do. And this show was helped in its preparation by Milton Miller, one of our associate producers. So we give him thanks. Asaf, I read today, we're taping on a Thursday, that the Israeli military assassinated the Minister of Interior of the Hamas today. Is that true?
True.
And I also see that there is a lot of movement now between Egypt, Hamas, and Israel. Gilad, your fellow in charge of negotiations for Israel, has been to Egypt, flew back today, and there's a lot of talk about a ceasefire.
Hopefully we'll reach a ceasefire in the next 48 hours.
So by Sunday when we see the possible?
I hope and pray. There's a lot of progress. Israel started working on the ceasefire with the international community from the first day of this operation. We worked with the Egyptian and with the United States government. Minister Livni arrived Friday especially for that. And I think there's a huge chance that we'll reach a ceasefire, one that will be a sustainable and a durable one.
You think Israel's getting a fair play in the American press?
In the American press, yes. It's not always the case in all
BBC?
The press. BBC is not an American press. The BBC.
No, but they show in America now. It's very
The BBC is more balanced than what they used to be. We still think they can. There's a long way until they will be completely balanced in our view. But if I compare it to the past, they did a better job.
They took some vitamins. The election in Israel is February 20th. Is
that February 10th?
February 10th. Is that still standing?
Yes.
And if we look at the situation today, and you're not a political person, so we can't talk politics with you, but I can tell the audience that Ehud Barak, in my opinion, is doing a very good job as a defense minister. He's a great strategist. I know him well. He's the most decorated military hero in the state of Israel. His one problem with the religious party, I told him, is in 76 he dressed up as a woman, went into Lebanon and took care of some business. And people thought the religious party, maybe it was a woman. They didn't know. They got excited. I tell it to him on television, so don't think you're hearing anything new. And Livni is the foreign minister. She's going to head Kadima. And Bibi Netanyahu is going to head the Likud. It's going to be very interesting. My prediction, not Asaf's, is you might have a combination of Bibi and Barak. I seem to think there's a lot of talk going on between those two guys, and it might be a good thing for Israel. That's not his business right now. We have to talk about the strategic. What was the strategic plan of Israel when they went into Gaza?
First of all, we wanted to stop the situation, the security situation, when Hamas is shooting missiles at our cities for 8 years. And we are restraining ourselves. We wanted to respond to make sure that our citizens won't be sitting in shelters for such a long period. As you remember, in 2005, Israel withdrew from Gaza. We did the disengagement plan. And we are sitting on the international borders. There's no occupation in Gaza. And we hoped that there will be peace.
You're an interesting man, because you were Ariel Sharon's spokesman.
During the disengagement.
During this disengagement. Was he tormented by that?
Did he? I'm sorry?
Was he tormented by making that decision?
Of course. It was very hard for him. He was, in a way, the guy was the father of the settlements, and he was the guy who sent them there. And for him, it was very difficult. But he said, you know, in order to give peace a chance, I will do this painful thing. And it was really painful. I remember him during these days seeing the pictures of the 9,000 people that were evacuated from their homes. It wasn't easy for us. It wasn't easy to the entire country. We were almost on the eve of a civil war. But he did it because he thought that this will promote the peace process and maybe will give us a chance to go along the roadmap for peace.
100% turnaround. And I use this metaphor all the time. People are coming at me because I was close with Jimmy Carter during the Camp David period. And Carter would call for a Palestinian state. And I say metaphorically, if you would believe that Ariel Sharon 25 years ago would believe in a Palestinian state or remove settlements from Gaza, you'd shoot me as a traitor in that country. But political things change. Realism comes in. What Arik wanted to do was keep a Jewish state as a Jewish state. He understood that. Same thing with Carter. Most people today, we want to feel that the demographics of Israel is a Jewish state. And we know the demographic studies at Haifa University do a lot of that. Arnon Sofer is doing a lot on demographic studies. Okay, so my opinion, I think Barak has put together a very good military action right now. I think strategically you've learned a lot from the Lebanese war. The army is well prepared now.
The army is well prepared, and it's a huge victory for us, militarily without a doubt. And hopefully if we can reach an agreement with the Egyptian, with international guarantees that they will stop the border between the smuggling that's going on the border between Gaza and Egypt,
it will be huge, the tunnels.
You're saying tunnels, people think that it's a small thing. Yeah. It's more like the Lincoln Tunnel.
Right.
They smuggle in two lions and a monkey in the last couple of months. If you can smuggle in lions and monkey, you can imagine what kind of weapon you bring in. And we need to stop it. We bombed most of these tunnels, but you can always build them again. That's why we want guarantees from the Egyptian and from the international community that they will do everything in their power to stop it. You talked earlier about the Palestinian state, and I want to emphasize, all three leaders that's running in the election right now, Netanyahu, Barak, and Livni, all announced that the day after the election, they will continue the negotiation with Chairman Abbas, the Palestinian president. It is important, even during this operation, we think that in the long term, this operation will promote peace. Because as long as Hamas is so strong in Gaza, there cannot be a solution for the Palestinian problem, and there won't be an establishment of Palestinian state. This is why I think in the long term, you talked about the strategic goals, this is one of them.
Well, last week I said, and I want to know if you would concur, that one of the important facts of this war is the fact that Egypt understands that it's better to have a friendly neighbor like Israel, even if it's a cold neighbor, than having Iran on its back. And we know, or you know especially, and I know, that the Hamas are basically in joint operations with the Brotherhood in Egypt that really want to overthrow Mubarak. We understand that, and we know that very well. And so I think strategically, the fact that Egypt is playing a big role here, along with the modern other states. I also have a theory, but this is a Leon Chani theory. I think the Saudi Arabians, in very closed doors, are dropping the price of oil, because I think the price of oil is commensurate with how the activities of Iran participate. This is not your theory, it's my theory. And I think that they are really on the side of Mubarak and Jordan, and they want to be, they're not crazy about Iran. And I think that there's a bit of underhand control of the oil, and I think Saudi is contributing to the war in that respect. But again, it's my theory. Paul Maidman at Forbes will probably concur, or maybe not concur, or maybe Lane Green of The Economist. So I'm not going to put you on the spot, but it's an interesting theory.
But what you said about Iran, this is the problem. The biggest war in the Middle East right now is between the inside the Muslim world, between the Shiite and the Sunnis, and the Egypt as the leader of the Arab world, together along with the Saudi Arabia, are fighting against Iran and their influence in the region. Egypt understands that Hamas influence in the region can go into Gaza, from Gaza into Egypt, and throw, as you said, President Mubarak. This is the biggest danger. This is why I think they are working to make sure that there will be no Iranian influence in our region.
What's the official reaction? You know, this new book came out on Sunday by a New York Times reporter saying that Israel had asked for permission to bomb Iran. What's the official government position on that?
That we read the New York Times. We read it.
Why did you bother? Could have read the foreword.
We read everything. Obviously, we cannot talk about that publicly. We have a problem with Iran. I'm not sure that the best way to attack the Iranian problem is through a military operation. There's a lot of other options we can work through sanctions, through the diplomatic sanctions and economical sanctions. I don't think that the operation right now is the best.
Have you any talk from the people on Obama's transition team? Have they come to see you? Have they talked to you?
No, of course, the Israelis know a lot of these people, but they've been very strict by saying there's a president of the United States and we are working with this
guy. They're all Jewish guys, by the way. You can have a minion over there with them. They're all the same guys. I debated Dennis Ross one time at Yeshiva University, and I said to him, you know, Dennis, when you were getting bar mitzvahed, I was making peace. So, but now he's an old guy, and he's supposed to allegedly become a Middle East negotiator.
He's 60. 60's not old. No, that's not old.
Sometimes we need fresh blood, fresh ideas, you know, sometimes it helps. Look, Arik Sharon, who you really were privy to, was one of the most creative guys I've ever met in my life. He was so creative. And tonight I must say that we lost Uri Ben-Ari. General Uri Ben-Ari was a very close friend of mine, one appeared on the show. He and Arik Sharon were very instrumental in the Yom Kippur War. Uri was deputy commander, and Arik crossed the Suez Canal, and I happened to cross it with him, with a young guy called Uri Dan, who passed away also.
And I was exactly a year and a half.
Old?
Yeah.
My God, you get peanuts for being there tonight, I'll tell you. So, Israel, if it comes out with a decent ceasefire and they have an they will not agree to any ceasefire without agreement to the stopping of the rocket attacks. Is that firm?
I think this is what every other country would do. You know, what would you do if people would shoot on your house?
No, I agree with you 100%. I don't want to see anybody make a political error right now because they're in a rush.
I don't think it will happen.
This is ironclad.
After we gave a chance to the international community to try to stop Hamas in the last 8 years, and especially in the last 3 years through the disengagement, where we didn't respond to the attacks, we won't go this way again. If Hamas will start shooting, we will immediately shoot back. I think that after what happened to them in the last 2 weeks, they will think twice before they'll shoot.
Are you besieged by reporters with this word proportionality?
All the time. You know, I'm telling to the Palestinian, I have the best offer for a proportional response. Don't shoot, we won't shoot back. This is proportional. Now, when somebody is shooting rockets on your cities, this is what they're aiming. 100% of our casualties before the operation were civilians. They are shooting in the middle of our cities in order to kill as much civilian as they can. The proportional response was to shoot back to their cities and try to kill as much civilian as they are doing. That would be proportional, but this is, of course, not what we are doing. We are doing everything in our power not to hit civilians. And if I look in the history, or not even in the far history, in the last couple of months, if I look to other places in the world and see what other countries that a lot of time criticize us has been doing, I don't think that we are doing an unproportional response.
We use the atomic bomb on Japan.
I don't even want to talk about 40, 60 years ago. United Kingdom, we mentioned BBC. United Kingdom were attacked by Germany. 80,000 civilian in Britain died. In response, Britain bombed the cities of Germany. 2 million Germany died in the civilians in World War II. But look at what happened in Afghanistan. In the first 8 months of 2008, 1,500 civilians died. Half of them died from bombings from the air. Only some countries has airplanes in Afghanistan. When you go to war, bad things happen. Israel didn't want to go to war. We strained ourselves for 3 years, and then we didn't have any other choice. That's why we started. Hopefully it will end soon.
What was Arik's feelings toward Abbas? Do you think he can make a deal with him?
He used to say that Abbas is not a member of the Zionist organization. But he thought that he's... when a lot of people say that he's different from Arafat, and he was different from Arafat, he said he's not a member of the Zionist organization, it's going to be tough negotiation, of course, but he thought that he's decent, that he's not promoting terror, and he's not saying, I want peace, but on the other hand, giving money to terrorist activities like we saw with Arafat. This is why he worked with him sometime, not all the time, but most of the time as the prime minister, and he wanted... Arik Sharon's government was the first Israeli government to accept the establishment of a Palestinian state in the resolution of the government. And he worked and he met him many times.
Can he survive now, Abbas?
Abbas? I think in the long term, I think he might be even stronger. Because Hamas, now everybody's united inside the Palestinian Authority, but people in Gaza will start asking themselves, why this has happened to us? It's true that Hamas won the election, but when they went to election, they didn't say, vote for us, we will shoot at the Israelis and get them back to Gaza. It's not what they said. They won on the ticket of fighting the corruption. Now, when Gaza suffered heavy losses, because Israel is stronger and we won the war, people will ask themselves, why? Why did you brought the Israelis back? They went, they left, no occupation. We could have done whatever we want. And this might strengthen Abu Mazen.
That's the hope. I mean, because we hope that the people who live in Gaza understand that Fatah could make a deal with Israel and live in peace, and their children, who we all feel sorry for.
Without a doubt.
To see civilians killed and kids, and everybody feels terrible. And the hope is that but Abbas is up for re-election, isn't he now?
His term ended on January 9th, a couple of days ago. But
according to my calendar, that's
right. But nobody, I don't think that's nobody in the international community will promote election in the coming weeks or month. It probably will take some time. But if a Palestinian in Gaza look at his brother who lives in the West Bank, he sees that in the West Bank, Israel is not attacking. He lives with a better economical situation because Fatah controls there. So they will start asking this question. We need to emphasize as much as we can the power of the moderate, the so-called relatively moderate in the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. And this is what we have been doing in the last 2 years, helping them through Chairman Abbas and Prime Minister Fayyad with money, with project, getting them cities that the IDF is not there completely. And it has been doing progress. There's a lot of progress.
The thing that's fascinating in Israel, and you know Israel, I know Israel very well, is the public is really united for this war. There's 90% backing for this war. You don't see Meretz guys crying and jumping out. You know,
Meretz supported this operation.
I know. And
that shows you that Israel restrained itself
they're
so
tired.
Long.
I mean, Shderot, I used to say on this show that there'll never be peace in the Middle East until Shderot is quiet, period.
Just imagine an 8-year-old kid in Shderot. His entire life, we don't know what it is to go out and shoot some hoops or play in a place that is not 15 seconds away from a shelter. 8-year-old. This boy saw in his life 8,000 rockets already. This is not a normal life. So because we restrained ourselves so long, I think the people in Israel understand that we didn't have any other choice.
All right, Asaf, good to meet you. Thanks
My
for coming
pleasure.
On.
Thank you.
My problem was I did meet Arafat, and I knew he was duplicitous. So hopefully Abbas is a little bit of a better man. And that's the hope in the Middle East, is that if Abbas can pull it together and bring Gaza together, it will be a Palestinian state. And the political people, as he said, all three of them agree that that has to be, and that is very important. That wasn't so 20 years ago, and he's a witness to that with Arik Sharon. We'll be right back with Paul Maimon and Lane Green. Paul's going to tell us about the economy, which is a mess. And then Lane Green is going to give us the economist view of the Middle East, which is BBC, maybe, no, but not Lane Green. We'll be right back.
What's wrong with this picture? Half of young Americans can't locate economic powers like Japan and India. 20% can't even find the Pacific Ocean. Without geography, our children aren't ready for the world. Geography is everywhere. It's incredible creatures. Rhythm. Fashion. Flavor. It's economics and politics. It's change. Understanding connections between people and places is critical in the 21st century. That's why we created MyWonderfulWorld.org. Go there now for your free parent and teacher action kits. And give our kids the power of global knowledge. Because kids who understand our world today can succeed in it tomorrow.
Oh, it must be careful. Well, that's a nice picture.
Come on, Anna.
Okay.
Foreclosure doesn't affect just you. It affects your whole family, too. If you've fallen behind on your mortgage, we can help. Call 1-888-995-HOPE, because nothing is worse than doing nothing.
You've known for years that this is the number one cause of lung cancer, smoking. That's why the Surgeon General issued this warning. But do you know the number one cause of lung cancer for non-smokers? It's in this room. You can't see it or smell it. It's radon. Radon is an invisible radioactive gas that seeps inside your home from underground. It can build up to dangerous levels without notice. Now the Surgeon General has issued another lung cancer warning. And whether you smoke or not, breathing radon can cause lung cancer. That's why you need to have your home tested. Protect your family. Call 1-800-SOS-RADON. Heed the warning. Have your home tested, because radon problems can be fixed.
Explore new worlds. Read. Visit literacy.gov and let the journey begin.
We're back. I'm Leon Charney. We are going to talk about the economy. No one better to talk to than the editor of Forbes. His name is Paul Maidman. You see him many times on his show, and he prefers us much more than he does Lou Dobbs. You know, I was with some CNN people. I'm not going to name them. They don't like Lou Dobbs.
He's a bit of a busted flush for them now.
What was that term?
He's a busted flush for them now. I think he's not getting the ratings that he used to do.
He's tiring, you know. I don't want to blast the guy, you know. I'm not that crazy about Keith Olbermann either, but it's a little, you know, I'd rather be on this show than on Lou Dobbs. You made a wise choice, Paul. All right, tell us about the economy. Are we in a real mess? By the way, first of all, did you pay your income taxes?
For which year?
Will you believe this? Is this a scene? Could you write this in a Harold Robbins novel? The guy is going to be submitted to be the Secretary of the Treasury, ran the Federal Reserve in New York, Tim Gunter, and didn't pay his taxes.
Well, when you're dealing with the sorts of money that the Fed is dealing with, you know, a few thousand here is barely notice it, I guess. I don't know.
It's strange. Maybe he gave it to his nanny.
Well, the thing is, it's surprising that this didn't come up with the Obama screening earlier. Because he seems to have been so meticulous.
Will they get him through? You know this guy, by the way? Have you met him?
I think that he will get through. He's very well regarded in Congress. He's very well connected internationally. He brings a great deal to the table. He certainly would have been my number one pick for the job. And I think his professional credentials will carry through this slight lapse of memory that he had over his taxes.
It's funny, though, isn't it?
Well, he's not the first person to have been done, but I think there's
genuine... Joey Baird, remember that?
Oh, yes, yeah. And there's genuine... I mean, the thing is now, there's genuine goodwill towards getting these people in place, getting Obama's economic team in place, because, you know, there is an awful lot of work has to be done. And I think America as a whole realizes that we can't afford to delay. I mean, there's, urgent work to be
done. All these guys. You know Summers, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of him?
Very, very smart man. I think Obama has done a very clever thing, putting him in the job he has done, rather than making him Treasury Secretary, for political reasons as much as anything else. I mean, I think he would have looked like a Clinton retread when you actually needed a fresh face. But nevertheless, he's a very smart man, he's a very good economist, and having his intellectual firepower on the Obama team, certainly worth having as a
president. I met him when he was the president of Harvard. He's a Jewish man, by the way, and he got a little bit hit on that at one time, and he defended his Jewishness very strongly. He's not a practicing Jew, I mean, to the extent that he runs a synagogue, but he defended his Judaism. Would this be a correct statement? that the worst thing that happened in the economy last year was the bankruptcy of Lehman that was allowed to go down?
I don't know if it was the worst thing that happened. I think it was certainly one of the watershed events of the year.
Yeah, I believe with you.
And it was up until that point, it had seemed that the financial crisis was, relatively speaking, being contained. It wasn't really spreading over into the real economy in any way that was threateningly dangerous. It was slopping over every now and then. But suddenly when Lehman went, it was like Katrina and the levee breaking. Suddenly this whole torrent of problems for the financial sector just swept into the mainstream economy and inundated it. And, you know, we were on the doorstep of a recession from that point on. So certainly it was a really important event.
It's a big event that happened today. We're taping on a Thursday. Bank of America had a deal to buy Merrill Lynch. Now, you know, in every contract, basically, you can bow out for adverse financial conditions or something. Ken Lewis, I know, could have backed out of that contract. The United States government forced him to go through it. They did not want a fiasco with Merrill Lynch. So they gave him money to close the deal. The stock goes down. Today, it went down about 20%. Mm-hmm. Why?
I think there is concern at the moment that Bank of America is taking on unknown legal obligations with Merrill from its thing. There is a lot of concern that it will take a long time for the two banks to mesh their culture. I mean, they're very different organizations. I mean,
I'm going to agree with that. Well. You know why? I think one of the worst fiascos in financial history was the combination of Smith Barney and Citibank. I think it was silly, stupid, egotistical, maniacal, whatever you want. I never saw it. I used to bank at both places. It never meshed. Never meshed. It's a bunch of egos of guys on boards who run companies who want to see these financial institutions be supermarkets of finance. It doesn't work.
It doesn't. And I mean, you should never underestimate the cultural problems. And this isn't the first time this has happened. As you've indicated, it's happened at other places before, and it's happened way back in the history of banking. The sorts of skills and attitudes you need basically to run a commercial banking operation are very, very different from those you need to run an investment banking operation, those you need to run from a retail brokerage operation. It's a completely different set of skills, of banking skills, of capital raising skills, of customer management skills as well come to that. You've got tremendous problems with bringing the different sort of IT departments together. You've got nightmare problems in bringing risk management together. I mean, operationally and culturally, it is a really difficult trick to pull off. And the bigger the ones they are, the bigger the problems are.
I agree with you, Paul. So why do they do it? Ego? What drives these guys?
Firstly, you know, everyone measures banks by assets, so everyone wants to be big. Everyone believes you have to have very deep capital pockets if you want to grow the business, which is, you know, true. But I think one of the lessons that's probably come out of all these deals, and certainly will come out of the experiences happening to Citi, is not only do you get too big to fail, but you also get too big to manage. And these organizations just become completely unwieldy. They're too big for one person to manage alone, impose their own vision on. And we don't have yet, we haven't yet found a magic combination of sort of boards of directors or corporate structure that allows these things to be decentralized in a way which keeps them innovative, keeps them lithe on their feet, and still just doesn't have them running amok.
But I agree with you, Paul, and all of these banks seem to be faltering. But the thing is, you'll never have a recovery in this country until those financial institutions recover a little bit, because they're the faucet that lends.
Absolutely. I mean, we've been saying this for the past, 18 months. Get the lending going again, the economy will come back.
But they don't. They don't get the lending going. And you don't get consumer confidence. Jobs are being lost. I was interviewed by Forbes. They asked me a couple of predictions. I said the unemployment go over 10%. I think wherever you turn, people are being unemployed. And another big issue is, should the federal government really step in and save the auto industry? That's not been resolved yet. They gave them a bridge loan, but that has not been resolved. And that's a political issue with the Democratic Party, who's obligated a lot to the unions.
I think also the way that it was done by providing that bridge loan was a way of basically punting the problem down the road. And in many ways, not unlike the Middle East situation, a hope that if you sort of can push off making the hard decisions until things get sort of generally better, then the hard decisions aren't so hard to make. I mean, the auto industry, the U.S. auto industry, is in a, you know, really is between a rock and a hard place. And certainly, I would find it impossible to imagine that the Obama or any other federal government would allow Detroit to go under.
They won't.
when unemployment is still high. They might be prepared and perhaps should be prepared to let it happen when unemployment...
Later on, maybe.
...is good, but not now. It won't happen.
And they put crazy conditions in there. They want to build automobiles that won't sell.
And the other interesting thing was is that apparently they slipped a little provision into this whole thing, which is that, you know, basically if the unions go on strike against the automakers, then the government can trigger a default. Which seems to be, well, I mean, that seems to be, to me, a way of making sure the unions don't cause trouble over this.
You think that congressmen are great deal makers?
You know very well my opinion of many of the abilities of Congress.
I was born in the same town. I know Barney Frank very well. He can make a great speech. Whether he's a deal maker, I don't know. I have great doubts. But then again, the people running these huge organizations, I think Pandit, who may be a nice guy at Citicorp, but the public doesn't believe him. So that stock is just going down, down, down. He'll probably have to be replaced. And it may be innocent, by the way. But
I think the problem with Citi's problem is it is still an institution made in the image of Sandy Weill. And you need someone like Sandy Weill to run something that big. And maybe even someone like Sandy Weill can actually only put it together. I mean, he couldn't actually run it when he got up there.
He couldn't run it. They never blended. Like you said, Smith, Barney never blended. Yeah. Look, you've been studying and been writing about economy for 20, 22 years, 25 years. Have you ever seen anything like this?
Funnily enough, I was talking to my staff about this last year, and I said, this is the seventh or eighth financial crisis I've been through in my professional career.
Yeah, but you said that on his show, too.
But I've never seen one of this magnitude. I mean, the numbers involved are just so huge.
They're staggering.
They are staggering. And, you know, like all financial crises, you know, they pass. I mean, that's the important thing, I think, to hold on to, that you know, we do get through this.
Yeah, but the question is when, and a lot of people get hurt until the when happens.
Absolutely. One of America's great strengths has been that, you know, it's been able to take some very hard decisions. It's been able to write off a lot of debt. It's been able to make the structural changes. It's pushed companies into bankruptcy that had to go into bankruptcy. It's taken all that pain, and it's taken it quite quickly. This time around, it's not taking it that quickly because of the risk to the financial system as a whole.
Right.
You know, we've had the bailout plan. There are certainly financial institutions that, you know, perhaps should have gone bust. It would have caused huge amounts of pain, maybe pushed the economy into a deeper recession than it already has been. Those decisions have been eased off a bit. So that sort of makes it suggest that this is A, very different from any other financial crisis we've seen, and B, that it may take longer for it to resolve than I perhaps first imagined.
How will Paulson be remembered?
I think Paulson will be remembered, I mean, in many ways, you know, he was the Dutch boy sticking his finger in the dike. I mean,
he
stopped, and how much it was him, how much it was Bernanke. But, you know, they collectively, you know, they stopped the dike being breached. And just in doing that, they may be remembered quite well. They will not be remembered fondly, I think, the Fed certainly won't be fondly remembered for years of cheap money before that, which certainly contributed to this. I don't think they will be remembered very much for the solutions they brought to it. I think those solutions we won't actually see those until this year, next year, two, 3 years down the road. I mean, the original bailout plan was, I mean, very ill-conceived.
It
wasn't well-formed.
Right.
Exactly, it was ad hoc.
Ad hoc.
And, you know, maybe they were, you know, and to be fair to them, you know, they had to play by ear. I mean, they hadn't seen anything like that before. They hadn't seen anything on the global scale. They hadn't seen anything with those sorts of numbers. So they sort of had to make it up as they go along. There was no playbook there for them to follow. But I think from stopping it having been a lot worse, we saw some remarkable central banking last year. There's no two ways about that. And I think they will, on the whole, be positively remembered for that.
I was sitting at a dinner with John Thain, the head of Merrill Lynch, and he said to me, you know, Leon, the worst fiasco that everybody will remember from this period is the collapse of Lehman. Why Paulson let it go down. I mean, there's rumors that there was something between him and Fold. I mean, but that'd be crazy. I mean, the betterment of the government or the world is at stake. So I don't know. But another thing that you're an expert
You've never run into clashes of personality in the financial world.
I have too, but not when it affects the world, you know. I mean, you got to step back on your ego. There's some people, you know, that we all don't like, but you step back. And I've heard that rumor a lot, and I don't like it. And Fultz is also sort of an arrogant guy who had an ability to do the job. He couldn't do the job, or he didn't want to do it, and his ego was struck. And they all had $100 prices, and they didn't know. They thought they were really worth $100.
I think particularly in that case, you know, he thought they could hunker down, they could see it through. And the misjudgment he, and he probably was not alone in this, made was the speed at which confidence could evaporate. And it wasn't really a... It certainly wasn't a capital problem. I mean, they had enough capital, but it was a credibility problem, a liquidity problem.
And you said something very interesting. You said out of the Forbes 1,000 billionaires or something, 400 will fall off or something like that?
Well, it's obviously too early to... we're starting to look at the numbers for our next billionaires ranking. I can't believe anything apart from the fact that their ranks would have been thinned somewhat considerably.
Yeah, it's amazing. All right, you're an expert on oil. Does the fact that oil comes down to $30, $35, is that good for the economy or is it negative for the economy?
Net at this point, it's good for the economy, and it's good for the economy for this reason, because in many ways it's a direct stimulus package into the consumer's pocket.
All right, but it collapses. Putin drives him nuts because he's depending on money. Chavez is
trying to... Yeah, but he takes it out on Europe on gas, so you don't have to worry about that here.
Well, but he has less of a trophy case. Chavez is looking Venezuela. He's looking to become a Republican or a Democrat, or maybe he'll probably work with Israel now. Who knows?
Iran, keep on working with Russia and China.
Iran is losing some valuable asset money, so which is good because they can't fund Hezbollah and Hamas. So from that point of view, it could be good.
It's certainly good from the point of view that there is a lot less geopolitical mischief that can be funded when there's low oil prices than when oil prices are high.
Right.
And it takes away some of the ability for people like Chavez in particular, I mean, that sort of president, to strut about a world stage and cause, just get in the way of things just through his strutting. I mean, I think in Iran's case, they probably do considerably more damage than just strutting. But, certainly it takes away the ability for the Chavez's as well to...
Paul, how big is your staff at Forbes?
Our staff
at Forbes? You're now the editor-in-chief. Huh?
Well, we're bringing together our online and print editorial teams to a greater extent than we had them together in the past. So we have an editorial staff of more than 200 people now.
And you have reporters?
We have reporters everywhere where there is news to be found and insight to be gained from it, yes.
You have a reporter in Israel?
We do not have a full-time reporter in Israel, but we have certainly people who go there.
Do you want me to send you some emails when I go?
Yeah,
we'll give you the insight.
You couldn't afford the cut in pay from what we pay.
At least on this show, we believe that Israel's getting a little bit of a bad rap, even in the American newspapers here. I think the Council General couldn't say it because it's not polite. But I think you see so much of this proportionality stuff, and it's untrue. I mean, what is proportionality in war? You want to win the war, and I think they're getting a bad rap. And I think Forbes is pretty honest in the way they report it. I don't think, I think you say what you have to in a very fair way. Do you have anybody in Gaza, by the way, reporting to you?
No, we don't have anybody in Gaza at the moment, no. I mean, it's not easy to get somebody in there. I think you have to remember...
Israel doesn't let the reporters in. They'd have to go through Egypt.
Yeah, you basically would have had to... I mean, most of the news coming out of Gaza is from people who are in there already. The thing also to remember is, we're a business and finance publication. Right. So we tend only to cover political events when they impinge on... the world of business, and obviously, peace in the Middle East impinges hugely on the world of business, so we take a very active interest in it, and we've written a lot about it, but we've had a lot of our coverage of it has come from outside commentators on our opinions pages rather than from direct reporting.
Where will the Dow be a year from now?
It's not where it is today.
Higher or lower?
Higher. I'm very optimistic.
You think there'll be a turnaround by the end of the year?
In the economy?
Yeah.
Yes. I think we're going to start to see expansion again in the second half of this year. I'm starting to see some of the little green shoots of growth popping around. A lot of it's going to depend on how well China's economy holds up. If they can keep it above that mystical 8% they keep talking about, I think that will give enough momentum to the world economy as a whole that it'll just carry us through until America starts
will
to recover.
Will they keep buying our treasury bills and bonds?
I don't think they've got a lot of choice.
Yeah, they have no place to go. People.
I mean, their trade surpluses are swelling, and they just had the second record month of trade surpluses. Because even though their exports are down, their imports are down even more, and augmented by the collapse in commodity and energy prices. So their trade surplus is very large, and they have to do something with that money. They can't wish it away into nothing.
I agree. And,
there's nowhere else to go but the dollar, really.
All right, Paul, always a pleasure.
For me too.
Paul says it's turnaround by the end of the year. I said the same thing to his magazine on an interview. I do think unemployment will go up, though, to 10%, and then it'll start to move around. And then also you got to take care of the housing business. And that's why these financial institutions are so important. I don't even know. One more question. They put TARP money in, let's say, the Bank of America. They take stock for that, the United States government, non-voting shares, or what do they get for that? Is it a loan?
You get preferred stock.
Preferred stock. No
mostly.
Votes. No voting.
Well, I think the idea is if you get preferred, then the banks can go out and issue some common. So that's another way of recapitalizing the banks.
Uh-huh. Okay, we're coming back with Lane Green, and he'll give us a little bit of the geopolitical situation. We've heard the financial situation. We heard the Israeli consul general. Now we need The Economist, which is, in my opinion, one of the best magazines in the world. They're really very thorough. And Lane is a great journalist, so stay with us.
I present to you Algebra 2. And finally, biology. Who among you will step up to their challenge?
Me.
Take on the tough classes now. You need them to prepare for college.
We're in an emergency situation. We don't have extra. We have a little bit of water and a little bit of food. A meeting place, no.
No.
I don't think we have a first aid kit.
We have tuna fish, we have beans, we have canned tomatoes,
true.
You know.
That's true, but that's really not survival food. Tomato paste.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Now, what'd she say?
She said whatever.
No, she says that all the time.
What's that?
Hello? I'm on the phone.
Mom, I'm on the phone!
Hello? I'm on the phone.
Who's this? It's me. I'm on the phone. Mom?
Oh, you're on the phone. All right.
Sorry. Anyway.
Who are you talking to? Kelly?
Mom.
All right.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to put up with you.
Any questions?
No.
You know.
We're not magicians. We can't read your mind.
We need your questions, each and every kind. Will this react with my other medicine?
Hey, what are all these tests even for?
Big dreams and good grades aren't enough to get into college. There are actual steps you need to take. Finding someone who can help is the first and most important. For the next steps, go to knowhowtogo.org.
We're back. I'm talking to Lane Green, who I consider a brilliant journalist at The Economist, which I think is one of the best magazines in the world, very thorough. And Lane always gets us up to date about how is the world reacting. So we'll talk to him. First of all, how is the world reacting to this Middle East war? Are they blaming Israel and the proportionality? Give us what you're hearing, because you're a Great Britain magazine, and BBC seems to report things a little bit on the side of the Arab population. What do you see?
Well, I think that you mentioned we've had the earlier guest, the Israeli consul general, right, here saying that the rest of the world media is not as favorable as the U.S. media is to Israel generally, and everybody knows that to be true. I think that reflects not just the journalist coverage, but also the general attitudes in those countries. And so it's no overstatement to say that the rest of the world is increasingly running out of patience with the war and is far harsher and more critical of Israel than the American media tends to be.
What's the policy of The Economist, the editorial policy?
Well, like everybody else in the entire universe, it seems, we're for a two-state solution, and now for a very quick end to the war, frankly. It's not serving Israel's interest. This is from a magazine that supports the existence of a secure Jewish Israel, that the war has gone on too long and has caused too much political damage to Israel's reputation and to Israel's friends in the region, Hosni Mubarak and Mahmoud Abbas, to help Israel politically, because the war has got to serve a military end of guaranteeing Israeli security, but I don't think anybody thinks that it's possible to take every single last rocket out of Gaza. It's got to also achieve a political advancement for Israel, which is to get closer to that durable solution. And we're concerned that it had the opposite effect. It might have moved the day where we get a two-state solution further down the road rather than bringing it closer to us.
Well, I've said on this show, the only way to get a durable solution in the Middle East is when the clerics in the mosque and the very Orthodox rabbis in their synagogues ask for peace. Yeah. Because if you're going to follow the Quran in a very literal way, and you shouldn't, because it's a great book and it's a very peaceful book, but there are people who want to read that way, or even the Torah, you know, the Jewish Bible. Sure. I mean, eye for eye, it doesn't mean you got to pull everybody's eye out. There has to be retribution. And with the IT, the information age, where everybody's got an SMS, and before they're in the synagogue, I mean the mosque, and they're SMSing people, you know, and then the word goes out. And so guys like Mubarak and King of Jordan, they have struggles to keep their population in order. It's a tough time, and you need the clerics to come with you.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if Mubarak doesn't want to see suicide bombers.
Sure. Well, that's the concern, that the war has weakened Mubarak domestically and that he's going to have to be tougher on Israel to satisfy a very angry Egyptian population. Frankly, he can't be seen to be too close to Israel. You've seen pictures of him with a Star of David on his forehead on these posters and different rallies around the Arab world and in Iran. That's a nightmare scenario for him. He's got angry sort of clerics, the Muslim Brotherhood on his back on one side, and he's got Israel on the other side, and it's not a comfortable position, and life is being made a lot more difficult.
I think he's made a choice that he'd rather have Israel than Tehran on his back. I think he's made that choice. It looks that way.
One of the most interesting stories, if you're just a journalist, one of the most interesting stories about what's going on right now is the role of the medium-sized powers in this, Egypt and France. The United States has been almost totally absent, aside from this sort of ritual
Bush didn't care.
Standing. Well, he's on his way out. He has no real power to move things very much, although he apparently, according to some reports, at the last minute decided to have Condi Rice abstain rather than vote for the UN ceasefire resolution. But by and large, the Americans have been on the sidelines.
Right.
The powers involved have been France and Egypt, and I think that's very interesting. If a ceasefire comes about soon, and there are rumors that it will come about, of course, we're a bit hostage to fortune taping a little bit before this goes.
Right, there's rumors tonight. We're taping on a Thursday night. There's rumors that there may be a deal on a table.
If that comes about, that'll be a huge boost diplomatically to France and Nicolas Sarkozy in particular, who's been running around trying to get people together, and for Egypt's role in the region. And there are a lot of other states that would like to see that happen, because if Egypt is a successful broker there, that weakens Iran, which is everybody's got their one eye on Iran.
What is Tony Blair doing now? He's a Middle East negotiator.
He has. He's been incredibly quiet. I mean, he's officially the representative of the quartet, so, you know, the UN and Russia. Russia has no role. The UN has been more or less ignored. Ban has called for a ceasefire, but unsuccessfully. There's been a Security Council resolution that's been totally ignored by both sides. So this has become very regional. The U.S. is out of it. The UN has been sidelined. France is playing a big role, but we're not seeing the usual powers taking a big role.
Your personal opinion, what do you think Obama will do in the Middle East?
I think that Obama is, by his nature and by his temperament, someone who sees both sides of an issue. He's just not an ideologue. He's just not someone who works from his heart. I think he'll sit down and say, how do we solve this? I mean, taking someone like Hillary Clinton, who savaged him in the primaries, and making her his Secretary of State, that's someone who's sort of temperamentally confident and calm.
Or good political.
And that too. But it just seems like everything he's shown me is that he will come with a hammer and a wrench and try to fix it, not with a sledgehammer and try to knock it down. George Bush is someone who divided it into the good guys and bad guys, and he picked off selective Arab good guys, but when he did that, backing the Lebanese president or the prime minister or backing Israel or his favorite sort of Arabs in the region, it tended to hurt them and to undermine them.
50 years from now, Bush will be considered a great president or a disaster? 50 years from now.
I think that right now, certainly, he looks like a disaster. He won't look as disastrous 50 years from now because Iraq cannot possibly look as bad as it does today in 50 years.
And 9/11. Yeah. There was not another 9/11.
Yeah. I think that certain presidents who leave in ignominy like Bush, they bounce back in history. Truman has been cited by some of Bush's supporters. He left extremely unpopular.
Terrible.
The Korean War and the economy. Nixon, same thing, left in, you know, scandal, poor economy and everything else. History looks more kindly on these guys than the polls do. So it could hardly look worse for Bush, but I think some of the damage he did to America's reputation with our friends, that's going to take a long time to recover, and it's not just symbolic. It's not just because you and I traveling abroad, we want to be treated nicely as Americans. It helps foreign leaders support the American position when their populations support America generally. And when America's unpopular with those people, then taking the American side makes it harder for friendly Arab governments, for European governments to be on our side as well. So we have an interest in being
liked. I think two of the most fascinating characters on the world scene today are Sarkozy of France and Putin.
Yeah.
And Putin, I always talk about. I think he's a demagogue and will remain a demagogue. And his tenure can be in trouble if oil falls. He keeps falling. I talked to Paul Maimon. I think it's more dire than that. Mm-hmm. There's scenes in Russia. You know, they have a good history of revolutions over there. You can ask Trotsky and ask all these other Lenin guys. Yeah. And they every 70 years, they get itchy, you know. And if that oil, because Putin is very famous and popular because Russia became like a Western country. But the ruble was devalued twice this week. Did you know that?
I did. And you know, he might have picked that fight with Georgia at the right time last year when Russia was feeling a little more confident. Now, with the oil prices down, as you say, you know, he's going to have a harder time throwing his weight around. We have these gas crises every year between Russia and Europe. In the past, it seemed like Russia throwing around its strength, and this time it seemed like a play more out of weakness.
What do you think about Sarkozy?
Well, he had a bad year, or he had a bad start. He came in
with a nice wife.
Well, that was part of the problem. He came in bad trouble. You know, the French are pretty tolerant of sort of extracurriculars and personal drama.
By the way, I heard a song. It's not that great.
Yeah. Well, she's easy on the eyes, they say. But the French are famously tolerant of this kind of thing. Mitterrand had a whole second family. The interior minister has just had a baby, and she won't tell anybody who the father is. So, I mean,
is that
France,
right?
She was the first Muslim Arab-descended secular Muslim minister in French history, and she's an unmarried mother, and the French people don't know who the baby is. So,
well, you could tell if she had a bris, a circumcision.
The long way of saying that the French society works a lot differently, obviously, in politics.
But he's a dynamic guy.
He
loves America.
He does. And but I think the thing he would like most is to restore French diplomacy internationally. Chirac vetoed the war, and for a while, you know, voted against the war, would have voted against it in the Security Council in Iraq. And for a while, France seemed like a sort of leader of an anti-American vanguard. But I think that cost France internationally in a lot of ways. And Sarkozy is now coming back trying to bridge a lot of divides. He's trying to be a good European and also be a friend to America. And he's created this Mediterranean Union, which will involve the European Union countries and all the countries with a coastline on the Mediterranean. So he's running around trying to be useful to everyone. It's hard to, you can't straddle two horses, you know, if they get too far from each other.
Are they a power, though, France? Do they have enough to be a power?
You know, diplomatically they are. People manage to translate medium size into greater influence if they have skilled diplomats and if they make the right friends. And the French have defied their medium size economically, militarily, and been a diplomatic player.
All right,
for some time.
Your magazine keeps a strong eye on Iraq. Mm-hmm. What's going on over there?
Well, the big news of the year is, well, the status of forces agreement has changed the game extremely. I mean, the American forces are supposed to be out of the cities by the middle of this year and out of the country within 2 years, which has changed the domestic political game in America, too. George Bush signed this agreement, negotiated the agreement, which takes all of the pressure off of Obama. If he started withdrawing troops, you could sort of get fire from a conservative rear saying he was throwing away a victory, but instead, it was the Bush administration that negotiated this. I think Bush did Obama a huge favor by making that deal. It looked like a climb down. I mean, it changed the statuses of American troops who can now be subject to Iraqi law under certain circumstances. So the game in Iraq has changed considerably, and particularly just politically.
What do you report? You have reporters in Iran, too. Mm-hmm. What are they saying?
Right now, actually, I'm not sure. We do have someone in Iran. I think we're writing from outside Iran. I'm not absolutely sure about that. We have an interesting series of elections. We have United States, Iran, Israel, and then Iran this summer. And we have provincial elections in Iraq this year as well. All of those are hugely important, and they all are looking at one another. Obviously,
Ahmadinejad, though, doesn't really have any power. The Khomeinis have the power.
The mullahs have the real power on foreign affairs, but they have a sort of veto role. There are a lot of power centers in Iran. The final veto is, of course, with Khamenei, the supreme leader. But the president has areas of influence, and he can have influence on foreign policy. He can certainly make trouble. And the Revolutionary Guard, sort of whose culture he shares, has an increasing role in the economy and in making a foreign policy as well.
Do you think they're really a big threat today?
Iran?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that they're moving towards a nuclear capability. There's this debate, are they trying to build a bomb? Are they not trying to build a bomb? It doesn't matter. They're building a legal nuclear capability in plain sight, and they're declaring that. They're doing the hard part now. So if they get as far as mastering the entire fuel cycle, including reprocessing, they've got multiple options, and they're close to what you call a breakout capacity.
I have a prediction. Afghanistan is going to be a real mess for Obama. Yeah. I don't think he knows how to get out of it, and I don't think we're winning over there. And I think he's committed to give more troops there. That could be a mess. Mm. Pakistan, we're all mixed up on. Mm. We don't know where we're going. And in India, all of a sudden, has guys doing suicide bombs.
Yeah.
So the world looks a bit tumultuous. The economy is going down here. So can I leave this show and be hopeless? No, I'll be hopeful, because I think the economy will turn around. I think there'll be a little bit of peace in the Middle East through a ceasefire, and I think that everybody's united against Iran and watching them. Lane, I'm not writing for The Economist. I'm only talking for the Leon Chani Report. That's always a pleasure to have you. Thanks for coming. We'll see you next week.
Good to see you.